Well, not far from my home is a tattoo shop named Man's Ruin. You ever seen it? Man's Ruin Tattoo and Piercing. I've seen their sign many times and often wondered how they came up with that name. Man's Ruin, you know? So as I was preparing today's message, I looked at their website to see if I could find a clue. Didn't find any. Until finally I noticed that the shop owner's name on the website is Heather Ruin. Imagine having a name like that. Wow, Ruin. Well, that accounts for ruin, but still leaves the question, why is it called Man's Ruin? After all, tattoos and piercings aren't accountable for man's ruin, right? And I'm still wondering how this tattoo shop got that name, but it did make an interesting connection with the theme and title of today's message from Romans 5, which is the ruin of mankind by Adam. You recall from our study of the initial chapters of Romans, the Apostle Paul had labored to prove that all men, both Jews and Gentiles, were under and beneath the power and the dominion of sin and had no righteousness whatsoever of their own. Quoting from Psalm 14, as his authority, Paul declared, "There is none righteous, no, not one. And therefore no man or woman, boy or girl, can become righteous or justified by works or by deeds of the law, since no one can keep God's law." That becomes very evident in our lives, doesn't it? But then in chapter 3, verse 21, there's a turning point. We looked at that turning point, that hinge, as it were, in Paul's letter, where he declares that the righteousness of God apart from the law has now been revealed. And sinners are justified and declared righteous by God on the basis of the imputed righteousness of Christ, which is received by the sinner by faith. And in chapters 4 and 5, Paul illustrates justification by faith apart from works, you remember, by citing some Old Testament examples like Abraham, whose faith is repeatedly said to have been accounted or credited to him for righteousness. Or King David, to whom God imputed righteousness apart from works. And what Paul does next in today's text passage, and also in next week's, is to further illustrate the gospel method of justification by means of a comparison or a contrast between the sin of Adam and the righteousness of Christ. Or we could refer to it as the ruinous work of Adam and the redemptive work of Christ. So today in verses 12 to 14, we'll first consider the ruin of mankind by Adam, and next time, next week, in verses 15 and following, the recovery of mankind by Christ. But today we'll begin again with the theme of the ruin of mankind by Adam. And our text passage contains 4 points related to the theme. I printed them in your bulletin, as usual, there on the right-hand side. Take a look under the sermon notes. First, in verse 12 at the beginning, sin entered into the world through Adam. Second, in verse 12, death entered into the world through Adam's sin. Third, in verse 12, at the end of it, death was transmitted to all mankind who sinned in Adam. And fourth and last, in verses 13 and 14, human history confirms that death has reigned over all of Adam's posterity. Again, the first point taken from the beginning of verse 12 is this on your outline: sin entered into the world through Adam. Look at it, verse 12. Therefore, Paul says, just as through one man sin entered the world. Paul begins by informing us of the simple, straightforward fact that sin entered into the world through one individual man, which of course refers to Adam. His sin is recorded, as you know, in Genesis 2, verse 15 and following, which is familiar, I trust, to all of us, where God forbade Adam to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Imagine God said, you can eat of any of the trees. You can have jurisdiction and rule over the whole garden and everything in it. Just don't do this one thing. Don't eat of this one single tree. Because, and he warned them severely, in the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die. Death will come. And sadly, Eve was deceived by Satan and disobeyed. Yet the primary responsibility for this sin did not belong to her. It belonged to Adam, because God had directly spoken that warning to him. And also because God had appointed Adam to be the head of his wife rather than allowing her to lead and influence him into sin. And therefore, Paul doesn't say, you'll notice, that through our first parents sin entered the world, or through Eve, but rather through one man sin entered the world. Sin entered into the world through Adam. Now this brings up the subject of representation. Kind of a big long word, but trust you've heard of it before. Representation. Because it's clear here that God appointed one individual person, namely Adam, to act as a representative of all humanity. And this is a common arrangement that we find in things like government and business, where representatives are chosen to act on behalf of the whole, right? On behalf of the whole country, or on behalf of the whole business. Mankind, as constituted by God, is a single entity. Listen, it is a single entity. One in which all of Adam's offspring are directly connected to him. And God chose, listen, God chose to establish an arrangement whereby the actions of one had consequences for all. In theology, this is referred to as solidarity. Maybe you haven't heard of that word, but it's a very real descriptive word for what we're talking about. Solidarity. It's used to describe the union that all mankind has with Adam. Let me illustrate. Some of my children gave me a DNA kit from Ancestry.com for Father's Day. That was kind of cool. Never had a Father's Day gift quite like that. And the results can provide a lot of information about your genealogy and your family heritage, as well as your ethnicity. And I'll have you know I am 87% Irish. Not everybody would lob that, but I do. But what the test won't show you, what it will not show you, is that 100% of us are descendants of Adam. Never get a report from Ancestry.com that says that. But the fact is that all humanity and every nation is made from one blood, right? Paul told us that in Acts 17 when he was explaining to the men on Mars Hill at Athens that everyone is made from one blood. So we all have solidarity with one another and with the first man named Adam. It will interest you to know also that in the Hebrew language, Adam means mankind. You can check with Jim, our word geek over here. He'll tell you for sure. It means mankind. So from a biblical perspective, the entire human race has union and solidarity with Adam. And all humanity was bound up, as it were, in his loins from the very beginning, way back in the garden. Hebrews 7:10, just make a note of it, we won't turn there, but Hebrews 7 verse 10 describes this solidarity when the writer tells us that Levi, long before his birth, was still in the loins of his ancestor Abraham when King Melchizedek met him. Kent Hughes describes solidarity this way. I quote him from his very fine commentary. He said, "The human race has a corporate solidarity in Adam. Thus all mankind was present and actually sinned in Adam. He was not a mere representative for mankind showing what we would do if we had the same temptation. No, we were Adam," he says. "We have solidarity with Adam," end quote. So sin entered into the world through Adam, because the whole world sustains a relationship of union and solidarity with Adam. Now for some, especially in America, this concept isn't easy to understand or accept, because as you probably know, our culture is highly autonomous and individualistic. And our crass individualism leads many to reject the idea that they could have any connection to or share in Adam's sin. That's a very foreign concept to Western culture and to the Western mind. Not so, by the way, to many Eastern cultures. However, the biblical truth is that sin entered into the world through one man, Adam. Because the whole world, each and every person in it, sustains a relationship of union and solidarity together with Adam, such that when he sinned, all who were in him also sinned. All of Adam's descendants, the entire human race, was bound up in his loins and would share in his sin. And would also share in the punishment of death, which was sin's consequence. That thought leads to the second point concerning the ruin of man by Adam, also taken from verse 12, which is this on your outline. Look at it. Secondly, death entered into the world through Adam's sin. The verse says, "Therefore, just as through one man sin entered the world," and notice, "and death entered through sin." The second point Paul makes concerning the ruin of Adam, or the ruin of man by Adam, is that in addition to sin having entered into the world by Adam, so too did death, the result of sin, also enter into the world. Now in the original creation, God made Adam without sin. Think of that. Let's pause. There was a time when man had no sin. He was sinless. He was completely, totally, 100% without any sin. And as such, death would not affect him, would it? Death wouldn't affect him. But God specifically warned Adam that disobedience to his command would subject him to death. And the sad record of biblical history reveals that death was indeed the consequence that Adam experienced for his act of disobedience, because, in fact, death entered into the world through Adam's sin. Now, when we read the word death, I think if you're like me, we all tend to think rather strictly in physical terms, right? And when you hear the word death, what immediately comes to your mind is probably something in the physical realm. And you'd be right. But certainly, it means other things. Paul intends for us in the first place to know that death, in fact, refers to physical death. The wages of sin is death, Paul wrote later in chapter 6. And the soul who sins, it shall die, wrote Ezekiel. However, sin results in more than physical death. Did you know that? It also results in spiritual death. The kind of death that Paul described in Ephesians 2, which is characterized as being dead in trespasses and sins. And then, in addition to that, there is the second death, which not only results in eternal separation from God, but also results in eternal torment and punishment in the lake which burns with fire and brimstone. Revelation 21. So when Paul says that death entered through sin, his meaning comprehends and includes death that is physical, spiritual, and eternal. And here's how we can apply this. The consequences of one act of disobedience are often much greater than what we would expect. Huh? The consequences of one act of disobedience are often much greater than what we would expect. Never underestimate the impact and the potential severity of one single act of disobedience. Human conduct reaches much farther and has results much greater for good or evil than any of us can imagine. Do you think that Adam could have even begun to imagine how consequential his one act of disobedience would be? Can you imagine? Commenting on this, William Plummer wrote, I printed it in your bulletin. Take a look in blue on the right-hand side. He said, in this life, we seldom have any adequate apprehension of the fruit of our doings. Every groan and sigh from men on earth or in hell may be traced back to the first sin in Eden as being in some way its cause. Also, the Apostle James wrote, behold, how great a forest a little fire kindles. And history has proven that one sin, listen, one sin can ruin an entire family. You probably know a family or two or three or four or five or six or more who were ruined by one sin. One sin. And one sin ruined the entire human family. One sin. Think of it. Powerful. Because death, physical, spiritual, and eternal death, entered into the world through Adam's single act of sin and disobedience. And its consequences are often much greater, much, much greater than we would ever expect them to be. Well, we come now to the third point concerning today's theme of the ruin of man by Adam. Taken from the end of verse 12, which is this on your outline, number 3, death was transmitted to all mankind who sinned in Adam. Notice the end of the verse. And thus, Paul says, death spread to all men because all sinned. Paul makes the simple statement that in connection with sin having entered into the world through Adam, and death having entered into the world through Adam's sin, Paul says that in connection with those things, thus death spread to all men because all sinned. In other words, with only a few rare exceptions, listen, with only a few exceptions such as Enoch or Elijah, whom God enabled to bypass the experience of physical death, there are no exemptions from death. We are all going to die. Unless, of course, the Lord comes and removes us from the earth, which would be wonderful, wouldn't it? Paul asserts death spread to all men because all sin. Now, here's where Greek verb tenses can shed a great deal of light on the Bible's meaning. I want you to put your thinking cap on now and track closely with what I'm saying. Look at that word sinned at the end of verse 12. Sinned. It's in the aorist tense, which signifies a completed action in the past. And therefore the expression because all sinned means that at one point in the past, all mankind had actually committed a sin, which of course, in the context of Romans 5, refers to Adam's sin. His sin became mankind's sin and was transmitted to all of his offspring because each and every human being was bound up in Adam's loins. As you may know, this biblical teaching elicits some vigorous opposition, we might say. Not a few people object to the idea that they sinned in Adam and that death is its consequence. They would like to charge God with injustice and impropriety, claiming that all men should not be held accountable for Adam's sin. After all, they argued, we weren't there in the garden when Adam's sin occurred, so why should we be incriminated? And why should we be considered guilty? How would you respond to that objection? Well, you might ask that question, you might ask that person this question. If you had been in the garden, I've actually asked some people this question, by the way. I didn't just come up with this for the sermon. If you had been in the garden in Adam's place, would you have done any better than he did? Ask them. Because you know, it takes a really proud individual to say, yes, I would have done better than Adam did. God really messed up. He should have appointed me to be mankind's representative. Things would have turned out much better if I had been the one who was there in the garden being tempted by Satan. Really? Be honest in saying that? Could a person really be honest and say that? But there's a better way to view this, which has to do with what Paul's main purpose is in today's text passage in verses 12 to 14 and also next week's in 15 to 21, which you'll remember, as I mentioned at the beginning, is to illustrate the method of justification by means of a comparison or a contrast between the sin of Adam and the righteousness of Christ, or between the ruinous work of Adam and the redemptive work of Christ. And here's the right way to view this. Listen. Listen carefully. As believers, we gladly accept the fact that by faith we died with Jesus Christ, right? Don't you rejoice in that? That you died with Jesus Christ? We're about to get to chapter 6 in Romans. And Romans 6 is all about this. We'll see it time and time again. Now granted, none of us would say that we were literally or physically present at His crucifixion, but we all confess with Paul that we died with Christ, right? Nor did any of us literally enter the grave with Christ, yet we would all confess with Paul that we were buried with Christ, right? And none of us were literally resurrected with Jesus. However, by faith we confess with Paul that we are raised from the dead just as Christ was. So, all believers confess and believe in their union and solidarity with Jesus Christ in His death, His burial, and His resurrection or His redemptive work. However, listen, if it were not true that all sinned and died in Adam, then Paul's comparison in these verses between Adam and Christ would completely break down. Completely. If it's not true that all sinned and died in Adam, then it's also not true that all who are in Christ are made righteous and live. And that's the parallel that we see all throughout the rest of chapter 5 and in other places like 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 22, where Paul makes the same comparison and contrast between Adam and Christ. He said, "For as in Adam all die, even so in Christ all shall be made alive." And therefore, if we accept that all who are in Christ and are made alive in Him due to solidarity with Him in His death, burial, and resurrection, then we must also accept that all who are in Adam sinned and experienced death due to their solidarity and union with Him. And thus, death spread to all men because all sinned. Not just some, but all. Death was transmitted to all mankind who sinned in Adam. Well, the fourth and final point concerning today's theme of the ruin of man by Adam is taken from verses 13 and 14, which is this. Notice, human history confirms that death has reigned over all of Adam's posterity. Verse 13, it's a parenthetical statement, notice. For until the law, sin was in the world, but sin is not imputed when there is no law. Nevertheless, death reigned from Adam to Moses, even over those who had not sinned according to the likeness of the transgression of Adam, who was a type of him who was to come. Now, in these two verses, Paul is asserting that sin and its deadly consequence has continually prevailed throughout human history. And to prove that, Paul explains that death reigned throughout the world at all times and in all periods of human history. First, notice in verse 13, he speaks of a time before God's law was given to man. He describes it as until the law was in the world. That is, until the law given at Sinai was in the world. So there's no mystery here. Paul is simply saying that sin was in the world long before the law of Moses was. Second, in verse 13, Paul says, "But sin, is not imputed when there is no law, which simply means that in the absence, listen, in the absence of specific laws that were later given by God to Moses, specific violations of that law could not be made. Until such time that the law of Moses actually existed and could fulfill its function and specifically define and identify certain transgressions, then Paul says sin was not imputed. It was not reckoned to transgressors when there is no law. And thirdly, in verse 14, Paul concludes with this statement, "Nevertheless, death reigned from Adam to Moses," meaning from the time of Adam in the very beginning, for many centuries of time up to the time of Moses before the law was given, human history confirms that death reigned over all of Adam's offspring or posterity. And you can read the record of that, by the way, in Genesis 5. Just make a note, I'm not going to turn there, but in Genesis 5 is the book of the genealogy of who? Adam, right? And it lists the obituaries of Adam's offspring who died prior to Moses and to the giving of the law. Paul's point is that there were many people during those centuries of time who did not violate a specific revealed command like the transgression of Adam in the garden, yet they all, in no uncertain terms, they all nevertheless died. Human history confirms that death reigned over all of Adam's posterity, even over those who had not sinned according to the likeness of the transgression of Adam, or in the same way that Adam transgressed. Death reigned and prevailed, even when there was no law. And there's only one possible explanation for this, namely, that all died because all sinned in Adam, who was the representative head of humanity. Well, Paul concludes this section on the ruin of mankind by Adam with a brief allusion to the corresponding and parallel figure of Jesus Christ. You notice at the end of verse 14, where Paul mentions that Adam was a type or a prefigure of him who was to come, referring to Messiah, the coming one. Paul is teaching us here that he will expound what he will expound upon next time in verse 15 and following concerning the second Adam, Jesus Christ, who, like the first Adam, was the representative of a whole humanity. And think of it that way. There are two humanities. There is a humanity in Adam. There is a humanity in Christ. And they both act as what's sometimes called federal heads or representatives of an entire humanity who are in Him. All who are in Adam are imputed with his sin and with death. But all who are in Christ by faith receive His righteousness and life. And in this way, Adam was a type of Christ, of Him who was to come. And this is the truth that becomes Paul's transition to the glorious gospel of salvation from sin and death, from the ruinous work of Adam to the redemptive work of Christ. And what a wonderful segue this is also to our observance of this table, where we remember and celebrate the recovery of mankind by Christ. And we do that against the backdrop of the ruin of mankind by Adam.